Welcome back, folks, to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. On today's show, we have Robert White. Robert has been practicing lighting design for over 30 years and is principal at Illuminart, based in Troy, Michigan. I got to read these things first, folks. He has a BFA from College for Creative Studies and has received over 40 lighting design awards, including several Guth Awards of Distinction. His wide-ranging design experience includes projects throughout the U.S. as well as the Middle East. He also enjoys teaching and is adjunct faculty for LTU and CCS. Before we get to that interview, though, we got to tell you about Griplock, Greg Garrett. Griplock Systems. Go to GRIPLOCKSYSTEMS.com, Greg Garrick.
That's right. Oftentimes you need to hang fixtures, especially in architectural type of atmosphere. So you're hanging a fixture. Now you also need to figure out how to get power to it. Well, you know what? Griplock makes it real easy for you with their Rincon powered suspension system. It's UL patented and recognized, and it's only available from Griplock Systems. It's a powered suspension system that has power and suspend your Class 2 LED lighting fixtures with a thin cable, providing clean, modern, and elegant look without the need for a separate power cord. Come on.
Get out of here. That's fantastic. That's fantastic. That is such a good idea. I just found out about it right now on the show, just like you folks. Holy mackerel, I got to go to griplocksystems.com right after this. And of course, folks, hey, if you're in the lighting distribution business, that's right. Do you have a warehouse? Do you take orders over the internet? And do you have people that are out selling projects and all that? Well, then you're a distributor. Greg, myself, and all of our good friends at the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors, we're getting together in September in Dallas, Texas, and we're having a big convention where we're going to hang out and we're going to solve all the world's lighting problems, especially yours. That's right. So why not join us? Why not hang out with a bunch of peeps who do what you do every day? And guess what? You trade ideas. You hang out. You have a beer. You talk about things. You share ideas. You make business happen. You do business. You make business, Greg Garrick. So go to NAILD.org, and there's all sorts of other stuff out there that we do, folks, of course. Robert White, welcome to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast.
Howdy. How are you?
I'm doing good. Doing good.
You know, Robert, I gotta start it off here. I know what a lighting designer is, right? But there's an application, or there's plenty of times where we're involved in quoting a project, and I'm going to give one specific example here where there's five different vendors. It's a project that's, you know, getting vendors from all over the country in a different market than I'm in. And they're going to get all these different opinions on what to do, you know, what kind of fixture to put in. The counts probably will be different because there's not, you know, one person doing the audit that they're all going to base it off of. But definitely the recommendations are going to be different. I want somebody to come in at the beginning and just say, let's talk this through and do this. And I'm okay if it's me, but it's not, you know, and I want more people to have the mindset that they need to do that. Is that your job? Is that what a lighting designer should do for us?
Yeah, actually, absolutely. For me, lighting design is all about collaboration. And it's also about looking at the whole broad range of products out there, lighting manufacturers' products, Griplock, which I've known of for probably easily 20 years now, which is the standard in the industry as far as thumb adjustability and all these amazing things. And I wish our luminaires are right above us here. We have the old style with the cable, the separate cable that's zip tied.
Griplock's getting another invoice after this.
It may be so much cleaner if the system was based using the Griplock system.
So
to answer your question, so a lighting designer, again, for me, for our group, is collaborative, and it's looking at the whole broad range of products out there, vetting things and working together to see what and decide what is best for a given project. And it's working with various reps, various agencies, and various manufacturers, and of course the owners and the end users, interior designer, architecture, electrical engineers, all those groups working together. But putting everything into the hopper, sifting it down, and ultimately saying, these are the specific light fixtures that are best for this project.
And you don't always have to have it all fancy and wild too, right? You can just have a standard 2x4 fixture, a wrap, or whatever it is, and not get too wild with it. Is that right? Is that what you guys can
Absolutely.
Do for us?
Okay. Yeah, because it's listening to the owner and the end user, and what does the space need to be used for? Every project is not and shouldn't be all about the photo op so I can win another lighting design award. That's sort of the last thing. Like, hopefully, you know, if a project works out, but what does the job need and how can we best serve the project? with lighting.
Do you get, when you do the specification and when you get involved in a project like that, do you factor in rebates? And again, going back to this application, if you do a specific thing to a fixture, you get way more money, you know, way more rebate money. Is that something that you need to think about as you're specifying too, if the customer's asking for that?
So, certain project, yep. And I think of projects where you've got an owner involved, and it might be a relatively small project, like houses of worship, for instance. And if there's monies that are available, because it's an upgrade, it's a retrofit that goes from actually still incandescent in so many of these churches, shifting to LED, and helping them go through the process to see what funds might be available, getting it pre-registered so that they can get a check at some point to help offset some of that cost. Not all the time, but sometimes.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And then, you know, you've already talked a little bit about it, but you have a defined process you go through when somebody hires a lighting designer. What does it look like?
Let's see, it can vary. Ideally, we are brought in right at the very beginning of the project, especially with the complex projects during the programming phase where they're still shifting spaces around. You know, the ceilings haven't been set yet and are looking for ideas. If we're in early enough, we can work with the architect and the interior designer to talk about the ceiling and how lighting can work with the ceiling, or how the lighting might urge the design team to think about a ceiling in a different way. So that's the early involvement, which is ideal. It doesn't always happen. Typically, we do get involved, though, during the schematic design process. Yeah, you know, the building is pretty well fixed. Ceilings, yeah, maybe they're pretty well set. And then we start developing our lighting concepts, and that's working in conjunction with the interior design team or the architects. And that's the typical process. We get involved in SD so that we start establishing concepts, getting the basic approach worked out. Then we get into the design development phase where now we're getting very specific. We want to use this specific light fixture. And then there's the CD phase, of course, contract documents, where we start getting into the finalized documentation of the drawings and specifications. And then into the CA phase, the construction administration phase, is super important. And especially for us at the very end, when light levels are being set, or if there's adjustable lighting that has to be aimed, or beam spreads that have to be tweaked, all that stuff, then ideally we're involved in that phase as well. So from the very early concepts all the way through to the grand opening, that's the ideal world. It doesn't always happen. Sometimes we get involved very late. Oh my God, the CDs are done, and we just realized we really should bring a lighting person in. And then we get the call. It's like, oh man, you're not giving me much to work with. But still, we can kind of hope, maybe tune things and make some subtle changes to bring the lighting design up.
Oh, and I assume there are ways that if somebody comes to you and says, this is my budget, this is all I can spend, you're going to say, well, this is all I can give you then, and you pick out certain parts of the process, and that's it.
Yeah, or stay through the process, but help them make good decisions as far as, all right, we only have these many dollars to spend, so where should we spend them? So instead of spreading everything out and getting sort of a mediocre result, perhaps we take some of those dollars and just concentrate them into one or two different areas that can provide a good, strong visual first impression, maybe in a lobby space, and then just be really smart with just being very budget oriented for the rest of the property or rest of the space. And I will say the best lighting designs from experience have resulted from very challenging budget challenges. And it forces us to be even more creative as far as what kind of light fixture can we use that's only $100 as opposed to something that might be $300, $400, $500 or even more.
When do you get paid?
It varies. Usually it's during each phase, so we'll bill monthly. And it could be 30 days, we get paid, 60 days, sometimes 90 days.
So you're actually billing for the knowledge, not the fixtures.
Yes, absolutely. That is correct. So unlike our local reps, for instance, who may offer lighting design services to a certain extent,
you know where I'm going
they
with
are
this.
Paid through the, you know, the sale of the light fixture, which is fair. Everyone has their own different business model. But for a lighting designer, especially if you're part of the International Association of Lighting Designers, the IALD, our bylaws state that we do not sell light fixtures. We don't get commission from the sale of any sort of light fixture. If I spec a whole range of project, and it could be a $1 million project, there's no subtle check that arrives to me at any given point for me, it's strictly our design fee, and that's how we make our living, and it's well and fair, and it's all above board.
Hmm. So, you know, that's where I'm kind of going to, I want to kind of parse out a little bit what a lighting designer actually is. It's a term, you know, like maybe there is now, but I don't remember knowing, is there a lighting engineer stamp, professional lighting engineer? I don't think that exists. There's electrical engineers that do lighting. Maybe there is. You know, what is a lighting designer? And I'm not talking specific. I know what an you explain what an IALD light, but a lot of people call themselves lighting designers. What are the different types, or what is it?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. Truthfully, anyone can be a lighting designer.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be pretty good, actually. I know some sales reps that are actually very good lighting designers. I know electrical engineers that are very good lighting designers. Mm-hmm. So lighting design, you know, if you've got the skill, the talent, the knowledge base, you can do excellent lighting design. And sometimes we struggle, at least in the Detroit area, and I think even throughout the, definitely the American market, is you have agencies that do offer lighting design services. I guess you could look at them as competitors to a certain extent. But then again, we need them because they provide us information, valuable information, or they provide pricing or samples for projects. So it ends up being a symbiotic relationship. We need them. They need us. They need us to specify their equipment. But there seems to be a demarcation point where some of the local agencies will provide lighting design on projects, and they tend not to be overly complex projects. For instance, it could be a series of small offices, mid-sized buildings, and they'll do the design work. And I have seen good results from that. And I have to be truthful and honest about that. But for me, for us as lighting designers, we like to think that we're able to devote more resources and attention and knowledge base to larger projects and coordinate things. And also look at the broad range of product out there that isn't locked into a particular line card from a local rep, for instance, because we're looking at all the reps' products. And as I mentioned earlier, sift through all those manufacturers and decide on what's best for the project. So to summarize that, it's a wider view of lighting design, a wider view of lighting product, and a wider view of technology that isn't locked into a particular line card from a local vendor or rep that has their specific list of lighting manufacturers to draw from.
So, yeah.
I don't know if that answered the question.
Yeah, you know, I gave you the first 8 minutes to yourself, you know, that, Greg, Eric. Go ahead, though, please.
I just need to know, how do you... How do you get out? How do you keep up with the information? And I assume there, at some point, you get some favorites, companies that you've dealt with without
Absolutely.
Getting paid.
I get
that, but you know, how do you keep up with it?
Yeah, so a couple ways that we do it. One is working with our local reps who have very strong relationships, and there's some reps here I've known since I've been doing lighting, and they're great, and they're trusted, and we have that collaboration. So that's part of it. They come in weekly. We always have visitors, and we'll give them a half hour. And just do a quick presentation. Here's the latest and greatest from this manufacturer or that manufacturer. And we absorb that information. But also, it's going to Light Fair. For me, I go to Light Build in Germany once every 2 years. It gives me a glimpse of what's happening over on the global market and some newer products that may not be available in you know, this side of the Atlantic. And it can give us a little bit of an edge on some of our lighting design competitors because we know this widget and they don't know it yet. They haven't seen it yet, maybe. And it just keeps us fresh and informed. And then whenever we do go to these events, because we like to spread them out, we'll bring that back and share it with our internal team. We'll share it with our engineering team because we're part of an engineering firm, Peter Basso Associates. And also what I'll do is I'll condense that information and share it with clients that are interested and do a lunch and learn. These are the various things that I've learned about to my trip in Frankfurt last fall, for instance, in Germany. It's always moving, and it still stuns me that however much I may think I've got the latest and greatest information, inevitably someone will come in, like last week, and here's a manufacturer, and they have this really cool acoustical lighting line, which is beautiful, and I didn't see that in Germany.
That acoustic stuff is so beautiful, is it? Like, it really is a nice innovation. Yeah.
It just keeps moving. So everything moves very fast.
There's an old adage that says if you don't charge for something, it has no value by definition. But I would also add that if you don't charge for something, it may not have any value, or there possibly is a catch, right? And what I've seen with the free lighting design model, and I don't know if you want to call them agents or reps or where people, you know, I use that model all the time, and it works great, where, you know, you provide a certain amount of information to the customer, but that does not allow them to get competitive quotes for their project. And I think there's, especially on new construction or major renovation, I think there's a massive value into separating out the cost of lighting design and having someone who is not tied to the sale of the fixtures be able to, we found an alternative that's cheaper. Okay, well, let the lighting designer, who has no skin in which fixture you choose, decide whether that's a comparable replacement or and that sort of stuff. This idea that the person that's doing the lighting design is going to be able to sell you the products, I think you're probably paying more in the end. And I don't mean to say that, I'm not being critical. I have been critical of the reps and the agents and in the past, but this is not meant to be critical. It's a business model. And I do it all the time myself because it raises my prices for my clients. It doesn't allow them to get competitive quotes. I keep the valuable information that I've discovered in my research of that particular building or whatever it is, and I provide them with the price along with the benefits they're going to receive and not all the information that they could send to somebody else. And when you're entering into a new construction project, I feel like the guy's got an 8,400 watt metal halides. I'm taking it out and doing something with sensors or whatever. But when you're building a building from scratch, this is going to come up over and over and over again as you build that building. You absolutely should have a separate lighting designer that has no relationship or monetary benefit from the fixtures that are being sold. And I'm saying that. I hope you can comment on that. But I really think that's so important for if there's builders or people that investors that are listening to this that want to build large infrastructure projects and commercial properties and so on.
Yes. And to have someone that's unbiased and is vetting all products equally, like you say, with no skin in any particular manufacturer specification, that's part of our charge is sometimes we got to make that hard decision. And I mentioned some of the relationships I built over the years with our various agencies. And there's three really strong ones here in the area, in Detroit area. You know, sometimes it's the call, listen, I would like to use your stuff, but it's just not right for this project. Mm. You know, of course we stay in touch. We'll think about it the next project, and the ability to just do an unbiased, unvarnished, but respectful critique and say, nope, not for this project. And it's done. And the owner can be assured that, you know, we're not doing it just because we want to fit it within that line card. Super important.
You're positioning within an engineering firm. So I assume it's a broad, it's not a specific, it's not electrical or mechanical. It's a engineering services company. They provide all the different types of engineering. And they've added this lighting design element. When did they decide to do that? And how did that decision get made to add lighting designers to their portfolio?
Yeah, so Illuminart was formed by Stefan Graf, who I still stay in touch with. And he formed it, I think, in 1985. And we'd always been friendly, even as competitors, when I worked for another lighting design firm in the Detroit area. We ended up partnering in early 2000. And I had my own company at the time, and I brought my work in, and we combined forces. And that was going pretty well. 2008 hit. Things were a little rough for a little bit, and then things picked up again. And it was about 7 years ago now that Peter Basso Associates approached us and say, hey, you know, we've known you all for many years. You've worked with us on multiple projects over the decades. Would you consider, you know, merging with us? And we put some thought to it and we decided to merge. And we merged. It was in 2016, actually. And they were really clear right from the get-go. We want the Illuminart brand to survive and thrive. It's not going to disappear within this engineering firm, which is very well established. Got about 100 engineers, MEP. And that's what happened. So we're still Illuminart, and our name's over there on the wall. Let's see if I can turn this over here. See it right over there.
There we go.
Yeah. So we have our own kingdom here in the center of the building, and we're literally surrounded by engineers. and we work on some of their projects. But actually about 75% of the work that we bring in is through our own auspices and efforts.
Hmm.
So it's good. So we've maintained our independence, but we've benefited the Peter Basso brand because we do offer lighting, and we've helped them elevate their lighting designs that their excellent engineers do. Sometimes we collaborate on things. Sometimes we kind of work behind the scenes to help them with stuff. And then sometimes they help us out with the electrical engineering aspect of things. So it's been a really good fit.
30 years, over 30 years, it says in the bio here. Okay, so you're going back to the 90s, into the late 80s and 90s with that. When we look prior to, say, 2011 or whenever you want to say that, you know, the LED, the rubber met the road with LEDs, you know, we had this incremental changing, right? Incremental improvements, right?
Yes.
How much changed between 1990 and 2000, say 13, 11, whatever date you want to pick? And then how much more, or how has the pace of changed since the LEDs took off? Can you sort of walk us through that from the lighting design perspective?
Yeah, so I started in 1989. I can officially say I've been doing lighting since the 80s, right? I had a mullet. I had a couple earrings in. I had like a jacket that had the zipper that went like here, you know,
as my puffy
shoulder stuff. Yeah. So lighting at that point, you're so right. It was incremental change. Oh, wow. Okay. There's a T12, which has been fading. Now we have a T8 lamp. But now instead of 2,200 lumens, it's going to give you 2,800 lumens per watt or something. It's like, oh, wow. You know, back then that's a big change. How exciting. Or this thing called the MR16 lamp was starting to develop. And it's like, wow, we can get it in 6 beam spreads instead of 3 beam spreads.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's the big change. So
swanky.
the slope was kind of like, back then we may have thought, wow, this is changing pretty quickly. But looking back now, the slope is something like this. But 2010-ish. Absolutely. When LEDs started to take off from an architectural lighting standpoint, man, it just skyrocketed. I do think it's plateauing a little bit. The innovation has slowed down a little bit, but definitely over the last 10 years, I mean, it just exploded. And the amount of change, and let me back up a little bit. The amount of change I still see and the amount of innovation with lighting products is still just amazing. Because as I mentioned, although I go to Light Fair and Light Build and all these things, right, try to stay up to date on everything, there's no stopping point. Because just last week, someone was in and it's like, wow, I did not see this before. This is really a cool way of doing this with lighting. And this wasn't around 3 weeks ago. So it's still changing very fast, definitely.
I'm going to give you a little anecdote before I throw it back over to Greg that happened just today, okay? Apartment building that we've been working with for many years calls, I want to change my lights to decorative. And we had walked him through the various ones he could pick. And we were talking about rebates. And I said, well, you can only get a rebate if you use a purpose-built LED light fixture. And you had mentioned to me that, you know, you wanted these fixtures to last 20 years or 25 years for you, and you're changing them. You put them in the 90s, and now you're going to take them out. We put LEDs in there, but now you want to make it look nicer or whatever. And if you put that, you know, solid-state fixture in there 24/7, you know, with an aux sensor that's turning it off and on 8, 10, 16, 25 times a day or whatever, I'm going to say that they're going to start to burn out. You know, a couple in about 3 years, kind of like popcorn pops. You get one and then two, and then all of a sudden, pop, 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 pop. And I think that popcorn popping is going to start between the years of 5 and 7. And then we're going to be changing all the light fixtures out again. And so you can't get a rebate unless you, if you use a lamp-based system. And he said to me, he said this word, that's unsustainable. I thought that's it. You know, I said, that's a big talk right now in the lighting industry, bud. Everyone's talking about sustainability. From the lighting design perspective, is it even possible to specify legacy lamp-shaped LED fixtures? Is that even possible in 2023?
Wow, that's a really good question. We've definitely been doing it less and less. There's a manufacturer, I don't know if I can mention specific manufacturers, but there's a really excellent screw-based LED lamp manufacturer. Begins with an S, I will say that. And I love
talking about Satco? You talking about Satco? Or is
no, it's Sora. I'll just say it.
Okay, Sora. Yeah, it's okay.
You've been around for some time. really great quality LED, high quality stuff. Where am I going with this? So I used to spec that quite a bit because maybe use a incandescent recessed downlight and then use this lamp, right? So we have a beautiful upgrade and sustainability. But that seems to have been fading because now it's dedicated LED because we get better performance, better dimming, better performance just all across the board. Plus these smaller form factors that aesthetically look great. Even though when I first started, we were speccing 8-inch downlights, right? Then we went to a 6-inch downlight. Oh, that's so refined. And of course, the architects are complaining, oh, it's too big, it's too big. So now we have these like 2-inch downlights and they're still complaining. Yeah. It's like, do you have anything smaller? Where am I going with this? Oh, so with the retrofit lamps, I'm seeing much less of that. I'm seeing more dedicated systems that we're specifying. I am a little terrified though. What happens 10, 15 years ago when these do need to be repaired? Is the manufacturer still going to be around? Although they say the form factor is going to be around and you'll be able to change that board because it has a QL code on it and you'll be able to fit something in there 15 years from now. Is that going to be the case? I don't know. So it's kind of a big question mark.
Well, so here's the concern there. And it goes into one of the areas that has not been addressed by the lighting industry is to the bean counters, the accountants. Okay. So light fixtures are amortized. These are set rules and generally accepted accounting principles, right? That you amortize a capital expenditure of light fixtures over 20 or 25 years, depending on which jurisdiction you're in and what rules they follow. Those people need to be told that amortization period needs to be 7 years now, bud, because you're going to be replacing light fixtures again, and most likely you're going to engage in a group replacement, some sort of group replacement strategy. And I'm as terrified. I'm not terrified because I think it's harder for you as a lighting designer because people might turn and say, well, why did you specify this? With me, I just say, I'm on the same side of the table on the warranty side with you, bud. Let's talk to this manufacturer about their warranty. But, you know, I don't think 7 years is a long enough or 10 years is a long enough life cycle for a piece of equipment that's fixed to real property. I think that's we need to have longer life cycles than that. Repairable, field maintainable. And I feel like it's on the lighting design edge that's gone the furthest down this solid state purpose-built path than any other, more than agents, reps, distributors, contractors. The lighting designers are the pendulum has swung the furthest with them. Just for all the reasons you said, all the performance things, the dimming, the tuning, the all the wonderful things you can do, except what happens when it burns out.
Yeah. You know, and then you compare that to take a university and they have 30 buildings and they all have two by four troffers that have been in for 30 years.
Yeah.
But you know, swap the ballast out, put a fresh lamp in there and the fixture is basically new, right? And you're not ripping anything out of the ceiling. Okay. Aesthetically, that's like a dinosaur, but you know, it is functional, does the job. And if we do an LED retrofit, you know, maybe we bypass the ballast, whatever. You're still maintaining that fixture. You're not tearing anything out of the ceiling. And as long as that technology is available, you're not going to be tearing that fixture out of the ceiling and maybe over the next 20 years as well, because it's a clean environment. The fixture really isn't degrading and it's truly sustainable.
Sure.
So you're thinking about, but are you actually getting asked? Are the end users, or your customers actually asking you the question about that? How do we replace this in the future? Or what are you going to do to make sure we can replace it? Or does it even come up?
Sometimes it comes up, and it's usually with the larger property owners, like those that may own a medical campus or a university with 30 buildings, like University of Michigan or Michigan State University. And they've asked those questions. But a lot of owners, they want the cool looking thing, and they're hired. That's why they're hiring us, because they want something to look cool.
So that
the building looks cool, so that when this tenant leaves 10, 20 years down the road, the building's still going to look cool and they can lease it to someone else. I mean, that's probably one of the reasons.
That's the pendulum with the lighting designers swinging the farthest with you guys. You know what I mean? And I see some of the specifications. I'm like, whoa. Like I'll get a new hotel being built, come out like a swanky hotel. And I look at this stuff and I say, holy mackerel. If something goes wrong here, this is going to be difficult to fix. Like just the way you look at the drawings and you're like, oh my God, I just look at it from the person who sells replacement light bulbs until recently. We don't sell many replacement light bulbs anymore. you know, it's all projects now, but for someone that used to supply hospitality like crazy prior to the LED, that was our business. We ship them boxes of MR16s, know, all sorts of stuff like
all
that.
All the Whole Foods stores.
Yeah. There you go.
16 based.
Yeah. You look at these drawings and you think, holy macro, there's so many components up in the thing going along. And I think to myself, man, that's hard to fix. That's really, really hard to fix if something goes wrong. And so I look at it, I say, man, maybe we got to put these people on a 7-year renovation cycle if they want that swanky stuff so badly. I mean, there's something, never mind that. Even the ability to communicate with these digital systems, you have to wonder if that's going to exist. Because I'll tell you this, my house is state-of-the-art 2005, okay? You can't hook any, I mean, it's still asking me for iPod playlists on like a, I'm saying? Yeah, the system, yeah. It's all whole home audio system, except you can't really plug anything into it because those iPads don't exist anymore. I mean, I think the lighting industry is on the way to getting extremely complex from the software perspective now as well. Like we're entering an age where not just your lights are out, but your software has failed. You know, you got the black screen of death on your lighting system now. You know, it's like, well, that was never a thing before. I think it's going to be interesting.
And the software hasn't been supported because the manufacturer maybe has disappeared.
And it only runs on Android Marshmallow 6.2. Doesn't run on Android Marshmallow 6.7 or whatever. I mean,
well, that's it. These are the perilous landmines, potential landmines we have to watch for. I will say, as far as the sustainability of the design itself, and we like to think we do this. I think we do. But I think of some of the larger projects where we have a choice to work with the architect. And instead of, it might be a hard ceiling, like a chipboard ceiling. And instead of doing a grid of recessed downlights, what if we are creative with the ceiling so that we create a series of channels or troughs or coffers that are recessed and maybe they have a dark finish? And we do a series of surface-mounted light fixtures that still provide great lighting. Aesthetically, still works very well with the ceiling. But now, if and when something fails, we're removing the light fixture and not tearing into the ceiling. So a good designer should always put themselves in the place of having pity on the facilities manager for a building. And also, like to your point, like to be able to literally access light fixtures, I've been up and down a ladder probably 10,000 times throughout my career, just aiming light fixtures. And I think of some of the Nike Town stores like we worked on back in the late 90s, actually, and literally learning I was risking my life to get up to a light fixture that I had designed to put into this area. And the only way anyone could get to it was to take a 20-foot straight ladder, lean it up against the window of the building, climb up the ladder so I could reach over and aim the light fixture. So having literally risked my life and realizing how stupid I was, to have some forethought and at least try not to do that all the time and be smarter with how things are designed into the architecture so that you can actually get to it at some point. Because you're right. And if a design is not sustainable because you can't get to the light fixtures and they start burning out, then that's not sustainable, is it, either?
Listen, the storefront displays, okay, those lighting designers need to get shot, okay? I had Louis Vuitton as a customer.
Wow,
I mean, risk your life. I told them you have to remove the glass to get to the lights. You can't get to the lights.
I believe it.
There's no way to get up there safely. And you literally would have to have an extension ladder and like literally strap it to the wall to get up there. Because, you know, you had to have it. The space was so thin, and it's up 20 feet in the air.
Like that was it exactly. For me, it was the Nike Town store, and it was the Warner Brothers store on 5th and 57th in Manhattan. And it was two stories up, and the window was probably 20, 25 feet tall. And literally, like you say, there was no space in that window display. I had to lean the straight ladder up against the glass, climb up, and it was horrible, right? So yeah, there has to be better forethought on so much of this.
Does all lighting design need to be cool? Can't we just have a nice practical in between where it's cool enough and it's practical and it works and I can replace
That's our job, Greg. That's not his job. That's our job.
So we're lighting designers.
There's always ways. There's multiple ways to do everything. So sometimes, right? You just be smart. Right. We have to be smart. Yeah.
So let's take an application that you've had where maybe you don't have a lot of experience. I know you probably do, given the amount of time you've been in it, but as a lighting designer, what do you go to for your resources? Do you go to like an IES? Do you go to, you have other sources? Do you just go to your knowledge base? What's the practice you go with there?
Yeah, so before we were a larger group, it'd be internal discussions with myself and Stefan Graf, for instance. Hey, what do you think? Maybe we try that. Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Or no, let's not do that. Okay. But I mean, there'd be some internal discussions. Of course, the Illuminating Engineering Society, the IES, is a foundation of so much knowledge, and rightfully so. And plus, it's at the end of all those IES files, right? IES, all the photometric calcs are run with IES files. Super important. So there's the IES database. There's definitely the experience level of just spending, making so many mistakes over the years and hopefully learning from them. And just tapping into our local network. But also, I found with the IES, especially like at Light Fair or the IES conference, you're talking with other lighting designers. And yeah, I mean, I guess they're competitors to a certain extent. But a lot of times, there's so many of us, it's broad, and there's a friendliness that you can kind of talk about things like, hey, I got this project. I'm thinking of doing this. You know, we did something very similar, and you may want to look at this manufacturer or this technique. It's like, wow, thanks.
If you're a distributor, that's exactly what happens at the Nailed Convention. Go to naild.org. Come hang out with your friends. What he's talking about is the sharing of knowledge of people who are peers in an industry. Like, come on. It's, you know, when you're with your peers, maybe your competitors online. Maybe your competitors. I'm just going to do a little pitch for the Nailed Convention here right now, if you guys don't mind. You know. Like, it's what's my payback? What are you talking about? You cannot possibly put a value on being with people that do exactly the same thing as you, are professionals like you. If you're a lighting designer, it's IELD. If you're a distributor, it's NAILD. If you're a contractor, it's NAMCO. If you're an agent, it's AILA. There's all these wonderful organizations out there. Get in them. You don't know everything. Those people are good. Maybe they're better than you. They probably are better than you, actually. You know, once you get there, and I realized that real quick when I got to Nailed that I didn't know anything about lighting distribution, actually. And I still have a lot to learn. So there, if you have light bulbs in a warehouse and you sell them to the general public, go to NAILD.com. org right now and join this organization. We'll see you in Dallas, you son of a gun.
Nice. And Dallas is a great place to travel to.
Yeah,
you got the Deep Ellum area, all those cafes, restaurants, bars.
Yeah.
Of course, for the knowledge, right? For learning. But still, there's some interesting places to see too.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, field experience. Because, and regardless of whether you're a designer or a distributor or whatever it is that you're, even if you're not in lighting, you know, how, you often hear about these programs like trying to get women into the trades, for example. You'll hear about that, or giving access to other communities to these types of jobs. Just get them in here and hire some people. You know, I really believe that the actual field experience, changing light bulbs or going and adjusting, having the lighting designer actually do the final commissioning in the field, I think that's such a huge point of learning in your career. And people dismiss it as if it's someone else's job, it's the electrician's job. But there you are up on the ladder, aiming the light because it matters, because you did that design. How important is that field experience on the lighting, getting to the job and commissioning the system and being there when it's commissioned? How important is that to a designer in their career?
Absolutely, absolutely critical. My early days, I was doing tons of retail. I mean, hundreds of retail stores. And it was getting out to the job site and focusing all those light fixtures, getting on the ladder, learning the mistakes of where not to put lighting, and then seeing what works and what doesn't. Getting burned, I mean, literally burned, right? It teaches lessons about being careful with the light fixtures. Of course, the younger folk these days, LED, right? Oh, they have no idea what it's like to get burned by a 300-watt double-ended halogen, right?
Even a T5HO, man, you could get burned on it. A T5HO was hot. Mm-hmm. Get out of here.
Yep.
That thing was hot. Woo!
Or you put it in slightly wrong and you get an arc, you know, like a little bit of electricity. So absolutely critical. And for us, especially with our newer people that come in, just get them out to the job site as much as we can so they can get up on a ladder and actually get their hands on stuff. Because we can run all the calcs in the world, but you got to see it.
Got to see it.
Yeah. Really understand it.
You got to feel it. You got to feel the effect that. You got to feel the effect of the lighting that you did. Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
That goes with being a lighting distributor. You got to see it, the field too, to know it. So that all that experience makes a lot of sense. We're going to take kind of close it out with one issue that's come up. this might not be published by the time that it is, but can you properly light a tall structure without uplight at night?
Watch it.
Tell us as a lighting designer.
Why don't we give him a little bit more detail?
You give it to him.
Okay. So let's say you wanted to build a temple in the middle of a dark sky preserve.
Yep.
Okay. So you know, they have different ratings, right? But let's just say the area has been given a certification by the Dark Skies International as being a dark sky preserve. And they have a no uplighting ordinance in the town. Okay. So no uplighting, shielded, strong lighting ordinance. And someone comes along and says, we want to build a temple to the god Apollo, okay, in the middle of a field, in the middle of a dark sky preserve. But we've hired a consultant, and we're going to uplight it, but it's going to maintain the dark sky standards, and we're going to aim the lights so it doesn't create any sky glare. Is that possible, or are we just drinking our own Kool-Aid? It is possible!
I think it is possible,
okay.
Only through recent innovation with lighting. Okay. So I've been wanting to do this actually on a building. Haven't had the opportunity yet, but I think it's some, like you say, it could be a 30-story building. How do we get uplight into it, or how we light the facade, right? Well, the typical approach would be bomb it from a light below, or maybe you got a accommodating building across the street that you can front light it with, right? But that's got its own problems. Or maybe you downlight it from the top. You know, which is okay, could work to a certain extent, but maybe there's some glare issues with that, or you just don't like things hanging over the top of the building. But I'm thinking, what if then this is getting involved early in the design process, working with the architect as the building itself, the bones are being formed. So what if instead of you've got a flat facade, what if you're able to take a portion of the facade and move it back a little bit? So just push that wall back. Well, now you've got a framed portion of the building. It's almost like a niche.
Mm.
And now you take a luminaire that has a very thin blade of light coming out of it, and you're able to light around that recessed frame now. And now that's glowing. And maybe there's some portions of that building that are pushed back from the facade that is stone or some other material that capture light. So now you can get a glowing niche that is facade lighting. The uplighting, the side lighting is controlled because of that very narrow beam of light, and it's not trespassing up into the sky, and you're still getting a beautiful glow on the building. So that's one thought. And of course, the other thought is you work with glass and the materials on the building itself so that you can get a nice glow from within the building because you're lighting the ceiling, you're lighting the internal surfaces. You're still going to get some glow coming out of the building, and some of that's going to go up into the heavens, of course, but still you're kind of controlling it. Or maybe you're designing it so there's some canopy overhangs that can capture some of that uplight, and you're not trespassing beyond that front face of the canopies, for instance. So I think there's some strategies out there. It's just a matter of getting involved early to help impact the architectural design and use of materials.
That's a fantastic idea, actually, Greg.
It is.
Thank you.
That's a really good idea.
Third cup of coffee right there.
There you go. Yeah, I thought you were going to say booze.
I think I had one martini lunch like 15 years ago, and by 2 o'clock, it's like, oh man, I'm really tired. You know,
oh, the last man. One. It has been such a pleasure, Robert White, to have you on the
Thank
show.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we've really enjoyed it. Folks, we want to talk to you quickly here about Grip Lock. That's right. Go to GRIPLOCKSYSTEMS.com, Greg Eric.
Right, and you can talk about or check out their Rincon powered suspension system. That's right, suspend and power the fixture with a nice thin cable, clean, modern, elegant look. Grip Lock.
Do it. Robert White just told you what's up on the show. If you made it all the way now, you have no choice. You got to go to griplocksystems.com. Get it right. If you're doing a nice application like he's got right there with his hanging fixtures, how good would it look if there wasn't a power cord, a white power cord going down beside it, tie wrapped onto the side, or BX tied to with the tie wraps, and it's twisting, and the fixture is getting all twisted up. Come on, folks. Go to griplocksystems.com. And, hey, are we going to see you in Dallas or what? What are you guys talking about? We're going to tour the Dallas Cowboys Stadium. We're going to hang out. We got all sorts of sessions going on. It's going to be distributor mania. That's right. You have light bulbs in a warehouse. You sell them over a counter. You take orders over the phone. You got a little website. You sell on Amazon. Whatever you're doing out there, sucker, this is the place for you. NALD.org. Check it out. And, of course, Robert White. We're going to put all his, he's got a lot of stuff here, Instagram, YouTube, LinkedIn, Twitter, and then he's got his company websites. It'll be all on the getagriponlighting.com website in the description. You just scroll down, you click it right there. And folks, if you made it all the way to the end, you know, Greg and I love you guys. We don't have listeners. We only have colleagues that don't do podcasts. So, hey, email us, check us out, subscribe, do whatever you got to do. Bye for now.